Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Greetings and welcome to Animal Instinct here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Celia Kutcher. I'm also known as the Food Healer, and today we've got a really, really serious show. I'm fortunate enough to be interviewing New York Times reporter and Polk Award winner Ian Urbina all about a series that he's working on called The Outlaw Ocean. This is a really intense subject. Today is a very serious show, and there's a lot of really important information that's going to be coming out, so please get comfortable, and we're going to get started. Hi, Ian. Are you there?
I'm here. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great.
Thank you so much for taking time to speak with me. Your series is really amazing and super, super intense, and I'm really thrilled to have the opportunity to discuss what you've been working on for quite a while now. So thank you for joining me on the show.
My pleasure.
So let's just get started. I mean, what prompted you to create the series The Outlaw Ocean?
So I've been fairly interested in ocean issues for quite some time, and in grad school I took some time off and worked on a ship, and that, you know, enticed me even further to take a look at seafarers as a group, and I'd actually pitched this story to editors before. And they had never bitten, I think largely just because it's expensive and disparate and difficult. And this editor, she had her own, Rebecca Corbett, my editor, had her own history with maritime issues, and she, you know, leapt at the chance.
Cool. And so how long have you been working on it now?
So we're about at 2 years now, from, you know, the starting point of an initial conversation to the full reporting. We're going on close to 2 years.
Wow. Wow. And I mean, your subjects are intense. You know, this is something that, it's funny because all the subjects that you've covered are things that really have never crossed my mind. I mean, you hear a little bit about these things, but you don't really know anything about it. So I think that the work that you're doing is extraordinarily important because, I mean, it's opening up a lot of eyes and making people more aware because, I mean, the ocean's a big place. So there's no way to know what's going on everywhere at the same time, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the thought initially was that, you know, 2/3 of the planet is covered in water, and much of that, you know, space is ungoverned and ungovernable, and why don't we go out there and talk about what happens out there and the people that work out there, and and that sort of was a simple grain of the inspiration. And then once we started spending some time on these ships, we realized there was a real diversity of different types of crimes that we should take a look at, and it sort of wrote itself from there.
And so let's, just for people that might not be aware of the series, I mean, the crimes that we're talking about are everything from stowaways to murders to rebel fishing trawlers and things like that. So, I mean, I'm guessing that your work is really dangerous. So have you ever feared for your life?
I didn't. I mean, there were moments when I realized that this was risky and maybe even dangerous, but the threat that, you know, in those moments I felt were usually less from the people, you know, who in theory are some scary folks, some of them, but truth be told, in those moments I didn't really feel like they would bring harm to us because mm-hmm. there wasn't a whole lot of interest. The risk usually that we were encountering, we being the photographer and the translator usually who was with us, had more to do with the conditions on the boats, you know, and these boats, some of them were in really poor condition, and we were, you know, on not, you know, great, you know, weather conditions, out at sea for a little while, and the sanitary conditions and the safety precautions, you know, were the bigger concern. Mm-hmm. And in one, there were a couple of isolated moments when I was scared. They were distinct. There was one moment on one of the trips when we lost all power on the ship, and for about 5 hours we were essentially lost at sea, and we had no sense of really where we were going or how to get back, and
wow.
We had limited fuel. But obviously we made it back fine, you know, and mm-hmm. And then there was another moment when our translator was very, very sick, and we had been up for 40 hours. This was on that story on the South China Sea, and we were having to sort of carry her around, the photographer and I, with us. And I really feared for her, mm-hmm. you know, because if we dropped her over the side, you know, they were not going to stop for us. But, you know, we all emerged, you know, quite unscathed. So
good. Good. And so, I mean, what is your goal with this series?
I'm sorry, say that again?
What is your goal with this series?
Location-wise?
Just in terms of, you know, why you're doing it, basically.
What was my goal with the series? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I think the goals were several. One was, on the simplest level, to take readers to a place that we all depend on. You know, 90% of everything comes to us by, of all the, you know, products we consume come to us by way of sea, and we rarely read about the people that bring it to us, mm-hmm. be it seafood or products or fuel or grain or anything. It all comes by sea. And so I kind of wanted to open up that space of labor to the readership. And also just to sort of explore kind of the last, in my view, the last great frontier, you mm-hmm. know, that exists. I think, though, a little bit down in altitude from that, I had the goal of wanting to attempt to make a point about the siloed nature of how we often think about the oceans, and what I mean is there are ocean people, you know, they're the whale lovers and the shark people and the sort of environmentalists, mm-hmm. Who are very invested in the oceans, and then there are the trafficking folks, you know, the anti-slavery folks and the human rights folks, and those folks are very concerned about labor abuses occurring and human rights abuses occurring. And I guess one of the points of the series was to look at the intersection of those two issues, mm-hmm. And those two realities, and talk about how the lack of monitoring, the lack of enforcement, the lack of, you know, real law out there has consequences for both of those communities, and then the rest of us, you know, who are maybe in neither camp per se, but we mm-hmm. all also depend on both the oceans for the air we breathe and the people out there for the stuff we consume.
Mm-hmm. And so what part of the world do you think has the majority of illegal things going on in the ocean?
And forgive me, there's a little distortion on the line, so if you can ask the question slowly, I can make out what you're saying a bit better.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. Let's see. What part of the world has the majority of illegal activities going on in their oceans?
That's a tough question. You know, so everywhere is the honest answer.
Okay.
I think the exception to that answer would be, I do think the waters around the U.S. Have a lot less of the kinds of abuses that we have been talking about. I mean, mm-hmm. there is illegal fishing. It's of a different sort than the type we focused on. It's typically, it was just a big arrest, I think, this week of a kind of mafia don type up in Maine. You know, they called him the cod father, you know, and he was notorious for catching beyond quota and misrepresenting his catches and money laundering and all this stuff. So illegality happens in our waters, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But the type of abuses we were focusing on was not, those sorts of abuses are not endemic to our waters. The acute, so in some ways, the question is better answered if you look at it by type. So let's say we're looking at the abuse of stowaways. Well, there are some real hot spots on the globe where there are robust communities of stowaways, even people who travel from other countries to that place, because those are known good entry points for stowaways to get on vessels. And, you know, in Africa, there are a couple. One of them is Cape Town, mm-hmm. South Africa, and there's a robust, you know, several dozen large, four dozen, I think, large kind of community that lives right near the port, and those guys, they're mostly guys, you know, they are repeat flyers, and they are attempting to stow away to get someplace else, mm-hmm. you know, someplace better. So, you know, if you're looking for abuse of stowaways, Cape Town is a great place to go because there's a lot of them. If you're looking for sea slavery and indentured servitude and child labor on fishing boats, well, you know, you can go a lot of places. Obviously, the South China Sea has a fairly acute problem, mm-hmm. it's been well documented, but one of the points we sought to make with one of the stories which looked at the Philippines is that this is not just endemic to the South China Sea or Thailand, and there's a pretty significant trafficking pipeline of forced labor from the Philippines onto a bunch of vessels, but especially Taiwanese tuna longliners. So you can go there, the west coast of Africa, mm-hmm. The Bay of Bengal is, when it comes to really unchecked violence on smaller fishing boats, these are not the Captain Phillips Maersk container ships. These are smaller boats and third worlders mostly. One of the most violent places on the planet is not a place you would typically think of. It's off the coast of Bangladesh. It's Bay of Bengal. Huh. And the numbers in those waters, there's several very well-established, organized sort of extortion, kidnapping rackets that patrol those waters. And the kidnapping and murder rate in those waters is really high. So it kind of varies, but mm-hmm. it depends on what kind of criminality you're looking for.
Wow. And so you've got many different episodes regarding different subjects. As you know, this show is really about animals. So what do you think is your most important episode regarding animals?
I think there are two. So one is a story that came out last week or a week ago, a week prior to this past Sunday, however mm-hmm. you say that properly, in the magazine. And it was a long story about, almost a David and Goliath story about the small Pacific archipelago nation of Palau uh-huh. and their fight to kind of protect their waters. And it's a great story in and of itself, not my handling per se, but it's this tiny, tiny little country which has the landmass of about the size of Philadelphia, but they have the water territory of about the size of France, and
oh,
they
wow.
have one patrol ship, and with that one patrol ship, they're trying to push back on hundreds of poachers from Taiwan and China and Philippines and Indonesia that are entering their waters. And it was just, I did an embed with their, you know, marine police for a week and, you know, sort of watched their sort of almost Sisyphean fight, you know, to try to, and in some ways, how does it relate to animals? Well, in some ways, it is a story and a lesson for the rest of the globe. You know, if Palau can win, the rest of the world, you know, might learn what they should be doing, other countries should and can be doing to police their waters. And it's a lesson about overfishing. You know, mm-hmm. we are raking the oceans clean of its inhabitants at a you know, kind of blinding speed because of technology, and fishing has gotten, the industry has become kind of more like harvesting than like, you know, fishing.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we care about the sort of life, the marine life, then we need to be thinking about whether we need to put a check not just on illegal fishing, but also on overfishing,
yeah.
you know, legalized industrial fishing. And that point, I think, comes across in that Palau story. The other story, I think, that speaks a little bit to kind of concerns about illegality on the seas as it relates to marine life is the Chase, which is this story about, you know, Sea Shepherd, this environmental group mm-hmm. that kind of took on this epic fight to make a point, which is that, you know, Interpol has these, you know, listed vessels that are supposed to be arrested on site. They're called purple listed vessels. There's only, at the time, there was only about six or seven of them worldwide, but no one, no country, no government was willing to actually go find these guys and arrest them. And even when these guys showed up in port, they were often let go. And so Sea Shepherd kind of set out to find them and chase them and make a clamor every time these scofflaws attempted to come in port. Now, how does that relate to animals? Well, these guys are on the purple list because they're, you know, repeat and long-running and quite lucrative poachers who are stealing fish from regions of the world where they're not supposed to be taking it. And and so, you know, that story sort of shows that, A, you know, this, you know, laws are only as good as their enforcement, and here's a non-governmental actor who's actually making that point that the laws can be enforced if someone wants to.
Nice.
So, anyway, those are the two stories I think that most touch on animals.
Okay, cool. I think this is a really good point to take a break, so we're going to take a break for about a minute and a half. We will be coming back shortly.
Hello out there, it's Steve Jenkins. I'm with Fairway Markets. White Leghorn, Red Wattle, Bourbon Red, Navajo Churro. Well, these aren't names you're likely to hear at a Fairway butcher counter or any other counter today, but before the rise of factory farming, you would have. And at Heritage Foods USA, you still do. Heritage Foods USA exists to promote genetic diversity, small family farms, and a fully traceable food supply. You see, we believe the best way to help a family farmer is to buy from them. And Heritage Foods is honored to represent a network of family farmers and artisanal producers whose work presents an immeasurable gift to our food system and to biodiversity. The meat we celebrate, whether it's heritage turkey, Japanese steaks, Berkshire pork, or Navajo churro lamb chops, is the righteous kind from healthy animals of sound genetics that have been treated humanely and allowed to pursue their natural instincts. It's a simple fact. Animals raised according to this philosophy taste better. And as we like to say, you have to eat them to save them. Visit us at heritagefoodsusa.com for more information.
And we are back. I am speaking to New York Times reporter and Polk Award winner Ian Urbina all about his series called The Outlaw Ocean. Ian, part three, called Sea Slaves, discusses the human misery that feeds pet and livestock. Could we talk about this?
I can, yeah. So, and it's funny, your last question was which stories most pertain to animals, and I didn't even mention this one. So this is a story that was focused on the problem of sea slavery, which is a global problem, but there's especially acute version of it on the South China Sea, and quite particularly with Thai flag vessels, Thailand. And the goal here was, and this is where you see labor and environmental issues intersect, so because of overfishing close to shore, it's become in the last decade or two much harder for fishing vessels to catch quota, to catch the bare minimum they need to make to break even near shore. So they've had to go further and further out. And at some point, you're getting so far from shore that you're using so much fuel that it's really not cost effective to do fishing at all, or you just have to stay out there. And that's how something called transshipment emerged. And transshipment is where these ships stay out at sea, sometimes for years on end, and they just keep fishing. And what are called mother ships bring fuel and parts and labor and drugs and food and ice out to them, and they bring the fish back to shore. And these fishing vessels just keep working. Well, this order of ship are notoriously the ones that have the worst sea slavery problem, because migrant, undocumented import labor is brought into Thailand. They end up on these ships. They're off at sea beyond the horizon, sometimes for years, wow. And anything that happens out there is beyond the reach of most government enforcement. So we wanted to get out onto some of those ships and just document what the work was like out there and the life. And the ships that we got on in particular, one of them that you read about, was a ship that was kind of the textbook version of this. It was four Thai officers and 40 Cambodian indentured trafficked, mostly boys and some men as crew. And what they were fishing for was what's sometimes called trash fish or forage fish, which are the small fish that you and I don't eat. They look like sardines, but they're bitter and they're not cost effective to sell for human consumption. But they're ground up into high protein fish pellets, fish meal, and it's used to feed livestock, so mostly chicken and pigs, as an alternative protein source from soy, or they're chopped up and used as chunks in pet food to feed, you know, mostly cats and some dogs.
Right.
And so this is a growing and robust kind of Western market, you know, the pet food market and
totally.
The livestock market. And a lot of the forage fish that are coming off these transshipment vessels are destined for it. So it just felt like doubly tragic, you know, considering what it was being used for, not to mention how it was being caught.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, there is one brand of pet food that is made in Thailand, so it's making me wonder if it would be a wise thing not to purchase that, like if a boycott on that would help at all.
You know, I'm a little unsure about the boycott issue because I don't think this is so distinct to Thailand that, you know, the pressure brought to bear there would. I do think that sort of public clamor about Thailand's particularly acute problem will continue to drive change, which has already started to happen in Thailand. But I think an outright boycott may end up just driving this. I mean, again, it's not my role to be an advocate to weigh in on this stuff, what I hear from sources who I trust who are in the region and who work on this and really kind of know the issues inside out is most of them are not actually for an outright boycott because they think it'll actually waste what leverage has been built up from this kind of reporting.
Good to know. And I mean, you bring up a really good point. I mean, your subjects are really intense, and I can't imagine how emotionally draining your work can be at times. So as a reporter, how do you keep yourself from getting completely affected and involved in it?
I don't know. I've never come up with a good answer to that. I mean, maybe you should talk to my wife and my 12-year-old and ask them whether I am really adjusted. I don't know. I mean, they might have a more honest and accurate answer, you know. I think my job. I think when you expose yourself to what other people are experiencing, it reminds you that you've got it easy.
Yeah.
You know, I may be visiting there and it may be grueling while I'm reporting, but I all the while know that I can leave.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And I always do. And so I never really feel, you know, I get it's not an easy job and these stories are not easy to report. I certainly admit that, but at the same time I never really feel. If anything, I feel guilty about the fact that I go there, I witness it, and then I leave, and those people have to stay there. That guilt kind of haunts me a bit. But for the most part, I guess I assuage it by thinking that, well, if I do a good enough job writing about it, that maybe it'll have some small impact on those very people whose story I'm telling.
Yeah.
That's the mantra, at least.
Well, I mean, I think it's so, you know, I have grown up on islands and I know about, I don't know, a thimble full of information regarding all of this stuff. So when we were first working on this story and I was reading your articles, I mean, I was totally blown away. I mean, I obviously knew there was some illegal activity, but I didn't realize the extent of it and the fact that it's global. So I think that your information, I mean, for me alone, it really opened my eyes and made me realize, you know, that I guess there's a lot of things that we have no idea of what's happening, you know? So I really appreciate the work you've done because it's really, I think it's a topic that not many people have covered because people are concerned about what's happening on land, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, well, first of all, thank you. And second of all, I do think, you know, this is one of the luxuries of being at the Times,
yeah.
in that, you know, it is a robust institution with a significant amount of funding behind it and a commitment, a true commitment, especially under this editor, to do this kind of costly, dangerous, long-form investigative work. And so I'm really lucky that I'm there, and they, you know, are willing to back it, you know, because it's not cheap and easy for them.
So after looking at all your work and looking at your articles, I mean, they're all shocking, but which one really blew you away when you were working on it?
Honestly, I'd say there were two that kind of most struck me. One was the sea slave story that you talked about, and I think that's for a couple reasons. One was it was the most grueling one to report. I was out, you know, with a photographer out on the, you know, South China Sea a lot of the time on boats.
Wow.
And jumping around from Borneo to Indonesia to Thailand and kind of just sort of constantly on the move, and then getting to port towns, getting on boats, going out, coming back, jumping to a new country, doing it again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this was the first of the series in terms of how it was reported. It's not how we ran it, published it, but I think that coupled with what I was seeing really wore me out emotionally. And there were some things that I saw there that actually ended up not being too prominently present in the stories,
mm-hmm.
but because they didn't fit. But I mean, Thailand has two big labor problems. One is the trafficked labor, largely from Cambodia and Burma, and the men get trafficked, you know, on the pretense that they're going to get construction jobs. They get brought in the country,
mm-hmm.
and then they end up on boats. And the women and the girls primarily get trafficked into the sex industry.
Mm.
And sometimes those two labor streams are actually interestingly intertwined, and you've got trafficked migrant girls being used to run up a debt on the trafficked migrant men, and then the debt is used to then leverage them to sell them essentially to boats because
wow.
they've got a debt on there. And so we wanted to look into that issue, and we went to one of these, you know, awful, awful border towns where a lot of this trafficking is occurring, and sat with a labor broker who essentially offered to sell us to 12-year-olds who were sitting at the brothel right across from us, and showed us pictures of, you know, a year earlier when they'd been brought into the country, you know, holding their stuffed animals. And I remember being haunted by that in a really deep way, that this was the, 21st century or whatever century we're in. And,
yeah.
and here I was, you know, sort of seeing that kind of negotiation on offer right in front of me. So that kind of stuff just really sits with you.
Especially when it becomes something really casual. So it's obvious that this has been done over and over and
that's
over
right.
again. You know, that's when it's like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Because these oceans are so enormous, do you think there's a way to control the crime that's going on?
I do. I mean, I guess I don't see any, this was one of the difficulties of the series, in that because it was looking, it was not a series about sea slavery. It was a series about lawlessness on the high seas in general. And we haven't even touched on one of the most gruesome stories, and one of the ones that I most care about, which was this murder that was caught on camera. And, so the series sought to look at, like, all these different types of crimes, and that means that it was never going to have impact in any singular space, because, and that's, you know, journalistically a challenge, because you can't show the metrics, right? But
mm-hmm.
on the other hand, I think that there already are a lot of steps being taken in each of the individual areas, you know, on that one case of the murder, there's a lot happening on the case of forced labor in Thailand. There's a lot happening on the problem of illegal fishing and the lack of enforcement of these illegal vessels. There's a lot happening. So each individual area has already seen incremental steps being taken.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I do feel like there's there's probably, you know, as Borges used to say, a nearing but never, or maybe it was Unamuno, but there a nearing but never arrival. You know, I do think that's kind of what we will see here. There probably will never be an arrival or a fix, but there can be progress, and I think we're already seeing a little bit of that.
That's fantastic. And so how does all of this affect the ecology of the ocean besides the overfishing? I mean, does the slavery, do the other angles do bad things as well?
Yeah, I think the simple notion is that, you know, when you don't have enforcement of laws, you have the ability to do lots of things, right? So one of the most striking statistics that we kind of came across in reporting, and it was just sort of a passing thing in one of the stories, but it was like a mind-blowing moment for me when we found it, was, every 3 years, ships intentionally dump. These are not spills, unintentional accidents. These are intentional incidents. Ships intentionally dump more oil and sludge into the ocean than the Exxon Valdez and BP spills combined.
What?
Right? So think about that. I mean, the amount of press that occurred surrounding those two spills was massive, you know, and yet every 3 years, the intentional dumping by the world's fleet of, you know, commercial and fishing vessels is the same quantity. And that adds up. The seas are big. Dilution is real.
Yeah.
But a lot of the sludge is, you know, plastic at root, and it does not biodegrade. And so I think and why is that able to happen? Well, you know, there's a lack of pressure brought to bear by countries to really exert an inspection regime, whether it's of fish or pollution or labor at the ports. And the result is you can get away with this kind of stuff and not even have to blink an eye, because you can cook your books really easily, because no one's really going to look at them that closely. Except, for, I mean, there are ports, the U.S. ports, the British ports, they're pretty rigid about checking this stuff. But the rest of the world, which is most of the world, is not.
Wow. So what is your favorite thing about doing this project?
Conversations like this, honestly, you know, with people that are really passionate about it and interested and have done their homework, that feels fulfilling, because it feels like an ongoing conversation that's running through society, and I'm a part of it. The impact it's having, you know, Secretary of State Kerry is quoting it, you know, at, you know, global conferences, and that means that people are paying attention, people who actually can do something. That's not me. And then, truth be told, just the reporting experience of getting out there on the ocean and sort of seeing the people and the life out there, some of it dark, but not all of it, that's just been amazing.
Tell you, better you than me. I get seasick in the East River, man. I would die in the South China Sea. It would just be the end of it.
Yeah, it's an acquired taste, I admit that.
Man, I mean, I'm telling you, it's like even on a cruise ship, I die. I mean, I can't imagine being on a fishing trawler. It's like, you're a very brave man. That's all I'm saying.
I think I just have the ears that are worth it, you know, that are sort of, for whatever reason, not built for seasickness, but I was lucky.
It's the worst. I mean, I was on a boat literally in the East River in New York City between Governor's Island and Brooklyn, which is like not even 100 yards. It was the 4th of July. I am dying lying over the side of this boat. And the captain, who I actually knew from years before, comes up to me and he's like, "Hey, Celia, you know what the definition of seasickness is?" And I kind of like dyingly like look up at him, and he goes, "It's when you really want to die, but you know you're not gonna." And it's like truer words have never been spoken. So thank you.
I mean,
and your balance.
Seeing other people get seasick made me realize it's kind of like back pain or an inner ear infection. It's like one of these profound sufferings that is very different than the acute bone break. You know, it's like a deep unhappiness.
It's like, horrible. And like people that don't know are like, "Come on, just have a cracker and stand up." And it's like, if I stand up, I mean, I literally was trying to bribe the ship. I was like, "I'll give you $500 if you just bring me close enough to Brooklyn that I can jump ship." And he's like, "You're not doing it." I was like, "Come on." So, yeah, I have a very high level of respect for anyone that can be on the ocean. I'm a Pisces. I'm a fish. I need to be in the ocean. So there's a big difference. And one of my favorite useless facts that I've heard is apparently if you take a live fish and you put it on a boat, that fish will get seasick. So anytime I start feeling seasick, I have this vision of like this gray like carp sitting on a deck like, ugh. That's really how it is. But Ian, we're running out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to share with the guests?
No, I mean, I appreciate you having me on, and I think the plan is to continue on with the series. The website has the current installments, and you can, you know, pass out my email if you want for people that want to receive it by email.
Cool, thanks. And then what's the name? What is the website address for our listeners?
It's just nytimes.com/oceans.
Perfect. Easy, easy, easy.
Yeah.
Cool. Ian, thank you so much again for taking time out. This was fascinating. And if y'all haven't read these articles, read them because they're amazing and they're so eye-opening. And part of it is depressing, but it's also really, really good to know what's going on out there. So, Ian, man, like I said, thank you for braving the boats and all the travel so that I didn't have to.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
And I'll tell you what, please keep me posted on what goes on. I'd love to have you back on in the future if you've got some more stuff or anything else happens. Like, I would love to keep in touch.
Great. I'd like that.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Okay. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Cheers. And for everybody else, I will be back next week with a brand new episode of Animal Instinct. Until then, thanks for listening and take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.